So section 4.8 deals with the homomorphic filtering methods, and we will skip that for now. Quite likely I will have some time, but I can't say for sure now or tomorrow. So we'll come back to this if there is time. So let's go to section 4.9. At the end of the chapter, I have some examples of application of the techniques we have seen to one, an ECG signal, and another heart sound signal. The ECG signal is fairly obvious, and you will do something similar in your lab exercise. So here we want to measure the heart rate and average RR interval from an ECG signal. And we know the detection of the QRS using the Pan-Tompkins method. So we will use that as the solution. Here is an example. This is a low-pass filtered version of the ECG shown in figure 3.5, which I believe is a noisy version. And this is the result of the Pan-Tompkins algorithm, which is very good. Clear peaks for every beat. Note that the T waves are fairly big, and also the P waves. And they are effectively suppressed in the Pan-Tompkins filter output. So apply a threshold and detect these peaks, and the interval between the peaks will give you the R to R interval. Now, whether you detect Q or R, it's not very clear. Depends upon how you correct for the delay between the output and the corresponding input sample. So regardless of the reference point that you detect in each QRS complex, this interval is referred to as RR interval from one QRS complex to the next. So this R to R interval, averaged in this case over all of these beats, is 716 milliseconds, and the effective heart rate for this period is 84 beats per minute. In this case, we have the data only for some 8 or 9 seconds, but if you were to measure it for a longer time, then you might get a different heart rate. Typically, the heart rate is updated in monitoring devices. You don't wait and count the number of beats for a minute. Typically, the heart rate is updated in shorter intervals of perhaps 15 seconds or 20 seconds. So you may count the number of beats, QRS complexes, in 20 seconds and multiply by 3, and wait for 20 seconds and update again, and so on. So the Pan-Tompkins method could be used here. And here is another example where I have a fairly noisy signal going up and down. That's a real signal. And something happened here. I don't know what happened. This is the signal that I was given from some other lab. There's some discontinuity here. I don't think this is any cardiac signal. There must be some artifact in acquisition, or maybe something got pulled or disconnected and then reconnected. I don't know what this is. It gave a huge output value in the Pan-Tompkins algorithm. So applying a peak detection algorithm to this is a bit tricky. So you have to update the signal peak and noise peak as Pan and Tompkins suggested in their algorithm. If you apply a constant threshold, if you say the maximum is here and apply a constant threshold equal to half of that, all of these beats will be missed. So this is the original ECG. This is the bandpass filter output. This is the derivative. This is derivative square. And at the beginning, there is some artifact of this record. And here, there is some other artifact. And these have given large values. Otherwise, these are the pulses for the beats. Once you get the beats, then, of course, you can detect the peaks. And in this case, the R to R interval is 446 milliseconds. The rate is 137 beats per minute. We have the signal for 20 seconds here. Okay? Yeah. Could be. It could be. There is, I think so. It is here at the beginning. Yeah. So the filters that you use for the total delay of all the filters, the output is not correct, not valid. So you'll have to ignore a number of samples at the beginning equal to the total delay of the filters. You're right. Whereas this is something else. I don't know what that is. Some discontinuity in the data. Okay. Well, let's look at another application. The problem in this application is a signal processing algorithm to identify S1 and S2 and break the PCG signal into systolic and diastolic parts with the assumption that ECG and carotid pulse signals are available. So it's a three-channel problem, and we have seen various versions of this and have already shown the results with manually marked boundaries, but now we will see how we can do using the signal processing techniques we have studied so far. So the solution, as you can guess, is to use the ECG to detect the QRS that gives S1 and the carotid pulse to demarcate the dichrotic notch, which gives S2 not directly but with a delay. So the beginning of S1 is equal to the beginning of the QRS. There is not much delay there. You can detect that using the Pan-Tompkins method. Detection of the S2 beginning point is a bit more tricky, and my grad student Rick Lehner, whom I mentioned earlier, did quite a bit of study on this issue. And this is from his work, where we wanted to study the problem exactly as you're seeing, to break the signal, the heart sound signal, into systole and diastole. And to do that, we need to get the beginning of the second heart sound. And to get the beginning of the second heart sound, we need to know the delay between the dichrotic notch and the beginning of S2. And there are some studies in the cardiovascular literature where there are some typical numbers given for these delays that are computed using certain other quantities that are commonly used in the analysis of cardiovascular function. To study this, let's consider the heart rate to be HR, beats per minute. There is what is called the pre-ejection period, PEP, which is the interval from the beginning of the QRS to the onset of the corresponding carotid upstroke. And then you need to correct that for heart rate. So there is a rate-corrected PEP, which is PEPC equal to PEP plus 0.4 heart rate. So this is from cardiovascular literature, as I said, with all these periods in milliseconds. And then PEPC has been documented to be about 131 milliseconds on the average, plus minus 13, which is the standard deviation. This is one standard deviation for normal adults. And then there is another interval that is called ejection time, which is the interval from the onset of the carotid upstroke up to the dichrotic notch when the aortic valve closes. And then there is a rate-corrected ejection time called ETC, which is ET plus 1.6 heart rate. Again, these are from the cardiovascular literature, and this range is 395 milliseconds on the average, plus minus 13 milliseconds, one standard deviation for adult males, and it's slightly different for females, 415 and 11 milliseconds. So knowing these rates and these typical intervals, you can get some other measures. Using PEPC maximum equal to 144 milliseconds and considering a minimum heart rate of 60 beats a minute, we get this PEP maximum to be 120 milliseconds. And then using the same minimum heart rate and the ejection time maximum, call that ETC max, that is 425 milliseconds. And then you get this ET max, which is 325 milliseconds. With these parameters, the maximum interval between QRS and dichrotic notch, that is what we wanted to get, that is 380 milliseconds. So Rick Lehner worked out this and said the search, the output of the second derivative based method that I showed earlier, in a 500 millisecond interval after the QRS. And after the dichrotic notch is detected, subtract the time delay between the beginning of S2 and D, and that is 42.6 milliseconds with a standard deviation of 5 milliseconds. So we are using the QRS complex from the ECG. From there, we are going up to 500 milliseconds forward and searching for the output of the second derivative method where you have two peaks, and then get the dichrotic notch, and from there, you go back this amount. So the procedure that we wish to use now to segment the heart sound into systolic and diastolic parts is use the Pan-Tompkins method to detect QRS complexes that we have seen so far. Identify one period of the PCG as the interval between two successive QRS locations. So you now cut one period of the heart sound. And in doing this, we have to make sure that we subtract the delay introduced by the Pan-Tompkins filters. And that is known from the design of the filters. And then use this method proposed by my student Rick Lehner, and detect the dichrotic notch in the carotid pulse. The standardized S2 to D delay is, we use mean plus two standard deviation, and that comes to 52.6 milliseconds. You have to make some assumption there. And subtract this delay from the detected dichrotic notch and get that as the beginning of S2. S1 to S2 is the systolic part, and S2 to next S1 is the diastolic part. That could include S2 and diastolic murmur, if any, and also S3 and S4 and opening snaps, if any. And S1 to S2 interval that systole will have S1 and any systolic murmur. So here is an example of application. So here is a heart sound signal, S1, S2, S1, S2, and so on. And this is the ECG. There's some noise and some low frequency artifact. This is the output of the Pan-Tompkins method. These are the points detected. I didn't process that beat. So from here, I mark the beginning of the QRS complex in the ECG, the triangle mark, and from there went and marked the same point on the ECG. That is the beginning of the first heart sound. The carotid pulse, this has been clipped and distorted. Somewhere along the chain, it got clipped by the amplifiers or the recording equipment or the A to D converter. I don't know where this happened. But the dichrotic notch is very clear. This is the output of the second derivative based method, and the second peak is identified. This was done by searching for the peaks. All of this was done in a MATLAB program, searching for the peaks and then marking the points in time. So this, from here I go there, and from there I go to the beginning of second sound, subtracting the delay. It may not be obvious here, but if you want, I can zoom up and maybe a little more. So here we have the beginning of S1 and beginning of S2 and so on. So this is systole, this is diastole. So here's a case with murmurs where it is not so obvious just looking at the heart sound. We won't be able to say which is first sound, second sound, murmur, and there is some other click here. There is a valve opening snap that could cause some confusion. This is not expected normally. So from the ECG, we know this is systole. This is the first sound. The second sound appears to be bigger than the first sound. It depends upon where you put the microphone. This is the carotid pulse. It's quite nice, and the notch is seen clearly. This is the output of the second derivative. Get the peaks, mark the dichrotic notch, and go back, subtract the delay. That is the beginning of the second sound. The ECG, the output of the Pan-Tompkins, this is the delay. Subtract the delay. I'm getting something a little inside the QRS. So this is a little here. Perhaps it could have been a little bit more could have been subtracted, but it doesn't matter. That is the corresponding point. So S1, systolic murmur. This is the end of systole. And second sound, and there's a gap, and there is an opening snap. Quite likely of the mitral valve. Here, this is diastole. The aortic valve is closed. The pulmonary valve closes here. Both valves are closed. At this point, the atria haven't begun contraction yet. So all valves are closed. And then the atria will begin contraction somewhere here. And around that point, it's a little early for this sound. I'm not sure what that sound is. It's quite likely an opening snap of the mitral valve, but that would come even a little later. So it is something. It's not clear. Quite likely an opening snap. So that is another example of segmentation of the heart sound signal. So what do you do with this is another question. Why do you want to do this? Having broken the signal into now systolic and diastolic parts, we could possibly examine each part separately and then ask the question, is there any murmur here? If there is murmur there, then we know it is systolic murmur. Then we know which conditions can possibly give systolic murmur. We could also segment this into parts. S1 is fairly low frequency, and any murmur is random. So you could do a test of randomness here, and then the random part will be the murmur. The non-random part will be the first sound. And you can do the same for the second sound and the diastolic part. Quite likely S1 and S2 will not pass the test of randomness. I haven't done that. I would expect them to fail. But if there is murmur present, there should be a distinction between the two. Having said that, I should also mention that there is no guarantee that murmur, if present, will be of high frequency. The frequency of the murmur and the amplitude of the murmur and the pattern of the murmur will depend upon the degree of the defect. So the same defect, such as aortic stenosis, could give different patterns of murmurs depending upon how badly the valve is stenosed. So one has to be a little careful in analyzing murmurs because their range is very broad. All we can say is it is relatively high frequency. So we can break the heart sound signal into parts because we know it is non-stationary and then investigate each part separately. In this case, there is an interesting application. Once you identify the beginning of the opening of the closing of the aortic valve, which is S2, you can study the components of second heart sound, aortic and pulmonary components, and ask the question, is there a delay? Are the two reversed? Which is coming first? And so on. So the next problem that I have been interested in for a long time is detection of the aortic component of the second heart sound and possibly detection of the pulmonary component and measuring the delay between the two of them. I haven't done that work because I never got enough data to do this. But recently at the conference in Lyon, last week before coming here, I saw a paper on the detection of the aortic and pulmonary components separately and measuring the delay between them. So there is a paper that came out just now on this topic that I've been wanting to work for more than 20 years. Now we know that the A2 component, the aortic component, is caused by closure of the aortic valve at the end of systole. P2, the pulmonary component of the second sound, is caused by closure of the pulmonary valve on the right side, the right ventricle. The relative timing of A2 and P2 depends upon the pressure differences across the corresponding valves in the left and right ventricular circulatory systems. As I said, across the aortic valve, outside you have the systemic pressure, and inside the heart you have the pressure of the left ventricle. The gradient is large. When the ventricles are contracting, there is more pressure inside and blood is ejected out. And when the ventricles are relaxing, the pressure inside could be low and there is more pressure on the outside from the rest of the body. If there is a defect such as aortic stenosis or aortic insufficiency, the behavior of the defect and the nature of the murmur will depend upon the pressure gradient and the size of that hole or opening. So we need to know the pressure gradient, or it is the pressure gradient that affects and determines the nature of the murmur. In this case, the closure of the timing of the closure is also affected by the pressure. The valve will shut when the pressure on one side is more than the other side. The valve will open when the pressure inside is more than the outside. They just flap, and that depends, that is controlled by the pressure. There are no other strings to pull here, and they are not operated by any other mechanism, just the pressure gradient. So in a normal individual, the timing of P2 varies with respiration. The pressure in the lungs will vary with respiration, inspiration and expiration, and the pressure across the pulmonary valve coming from the lungs will also vary with respiration. The timing of A2, the aortic component, is independent of respiration because the systemic pressure is not affected by respiration. The pulmonary or intrathoracic pressure is decreased during inspiration, leading to delayed closure of the pulmonary valve. So when you are taking your breath in, the pressure is decreased and the pulmonary valve closes a little later than during expiration. So the gap between A2 and P2 will increase when you breathe in. When you breathe out, the gap will decrease and the two sounds will merge and you won't see any separation. So the gap will be closed and A2, P2 will overlap during expiration in normal individuals. But if during expiration the gap persists, then there could be something suspected to be wrong. So A2 and P2 have individual durations that are fairly short, only about 50 milliseconds, and the gap is of the order of the same 30-40 milliseconds during inspiration. But splits as long as 100 milliseconds have been recorded when P2 is delayed. A2 and P2 could be separated by up to 100 milliseconds, but that's about the maximum that's been recorded. A split in S2 that is more than 40 milliseconds during sustained expiration is considered to be abnormal. And complete right bundle branch block could also cause delayed activation of the right ventricle. So there is a gap between the activation of the right and left ventricles if the right bundle branch is blocked. That will delay the pulmonary valve closure because it's not the valve that is activated by the bundle branch blocks, but the contraction of the right ventricle is initiated by the Purkinje fibers, and if the corresponding bundle branch is blocked, then there will be a delay in the compression, the contraction, and hence the closure. So that will also lead to widely split S2. And there are a few other conditions, atrial septal defect, ventricular septal defect, and pulmonary stenosis, that could also cause wide split in S2. There are other conditions that can cause delay in the atrial valve closure, and you can imagine, on the other side it was right bundle branch. Now, if you consider left bundle branch block, and if the left ventricle is contracting at a later time than the right ventricle, then the aortic valve will close later. So left bundle branch block will delay the contraction of the left ventricle and hence delay the aortic valve closure, and that is with respect to the right, whatever is happening on the right side. And then A2 could appear after P2, which is called reverse splitting. A2 is delayed more, whereas typically it comes first. Aortic insufficiency and abnormally early pulmonary valve closure also could cause reverse splitting. So in these cases, it is evident that the identification of A2 and P2 could assist in the diagnosis of several cardiovascular diseases and defects. Now, this is done by cardiologists using just a stethoscope. They are highly trained. And to do this, they have to listen to the sound at different locations, places where the aortic sound is heard best and places where the pulmonary sound is heard best, so they can identify which is aortic component, which is pulmonary component, which is coming first and which is coming second, how is the split varying with inspiration and expiration, and they can arrive at this diagnosis. So now the question is, can we do this using signal processing techniques. So given that the second heart sound S2 is made up of an aortic component A2 and a pulmonary component P2 with variable temporal relationships, is it possible to detect only A2? But there is an interesting solution to this, which is detect the diachronic notch in the carotid pulse signal, detect the beginning of S2, and assuming that the patient has been breathing and not holding the breath during recording, A2 is always at the same position in the segmented signal. P2 keeps moving back and forth. So direct relationship between aortic valve closure, aortic incisura, and consequently the direct diachronic notch, that is what we have. Detect and segment S2 over several cardiac and respiratory cycles. So we need the subject to go through several respiration cycles of inspiration and expiration so we can make use of this relationship. The aortic valve always closes at the same instant of time as marked by the diachronic notch. With reference to that, the pulmonary component is moving back and forth with respiration. And because these are vibration waves, suppose you perform synchronized averaging of S2 using the diachronic notch as the trigger or reference point to synchronize. A2 appears at the same instant in every S2 segment, so it will be strengthened by synchronized averaging. P2 appears at different times, and hence it will be canceled. Because these are vibration waves, they do not have any particular waveform, and the positive and negative phases will be canceled out. That's the expectation. So this is one example where I tried this method. So here we have several observations of S2 segmented automatically using the method I described earlier. Detect the QRS complex, detect the diachronic notch, and cut at that point. So each one of this is the diastolic portion including S2, with the diachronic notch being somewhere there, and this is the beginning of S2 detected using the diachronic notch as the reference. And A2 is expected to be here always, not this. And P2 is changing, the duration is changing, as you can see. There is a component here that moves out and then comes back. And here, the two of them overlap. So here they are close by, here they are moving apart, here they are maximally apart, and here they are coming close again. And this is the two of them merged in one beat. This is a sequence of how many beats? In this case, it's a 7-year-old female patient with atrial septal defect that is leading to a variable split in S2. And I'm showing 9 consecutive segments of S2 from the top to here. And the last one, this is the average over 21 beats. And in this case, I expect the patient would have breathed in and out a few times. In 21 beats, it will be not that many, maybe 3-4 breath cycles. Perhaps the typical breathing rate is, let's say, 15. The heart rate could be 75, so there could be a factor of 5. And 20 beats would be, let's say, 4 breath cycles. That was not recorded. So I'm just estimating during the period of the ECG with or the heart sound with 21 beats, the subject might have gone through 4 or 5 breath cycles, respiration cycles. So averaging over so many cycles, I got this, where I expect this to be only the aortic component, and the pulmonary component, all of these, I expect, has been cancelled out by averaging. There's no proof for this, because I don't have any other recording to compare with, but that's the expectation. So what can you do with this? It is possible then to go back and subtract the aortic component from each one of them. And then what is left is the pulmonary component. Can you get something from the pulmonary component that is related to pulmonary pressure is a question. If you can do that, then you get a correlate of the pulmonary pressure from just the heart sound. You can estimate the delay between the two, and then you can also try to correlate this with pulmonary pressure, and if you can do that, you could possibly detect pulmonary hypertension. There is no non-invasive way of getting the pulmonary pressure. What you get here is the blood pressure, but the pulmonary pressure in the lungs cannot be obtained non-invasively. This could possibly be a method, but I have not been able to work on this, although this is a problem that has been of my interest for several years due to lack of availability of data and funding. But recently I saw a paper on this just last week, so there is interest in this area, at least in one other person. Okay, that closes chapter 4. Any questions on chapter 4, detection of events? I skipped the complex the homomorphic filter and the capstrom. We will see if there is time. We'll come back to that. Yeah, you had a question. I haven't seen the paper yet. I saw the poster. I have the CD-ROM with me, but I haven't read the paper yet. They were interested only in estimating the time delay between A2 and P2. I can't remember if they applied it to any clinical situation. That also I don't remember. I saw only the poster and then I haven't read the paper yet. Yes, yes, on the chest. Yeah, the heart sound will be recorded on the chest. Yeah. There have been several other techniques to record multi-channel heart sounds using small transducers or some sort of a, I don't know what that is called, some sort of a device that is a transducer that is a continuous film. Apply it and you get essentially an image, but the image is that of the pressure at every point. So you can essentially map the intensity of the heart sounds over the entire chest. Not continuously, but over a distribution of several points. And that was done quite a few years ago. But I have not seen many papers where this interval has been measured and correlated with any particular pathological condition. This reference, I have just noted it from last week at the conference in Lyon until last Sunday, and then I came here. I haven't read that yet. Okay, it's been a little, almost an hour, so let's take a break here and then come back in 10 minutes, 4:45, and we'll go till 6 o'clock and go with chapter 5 when you come back.